This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We're not alone on this earth experiencing a rapid shift of climate. Our next guest is a voice for the wild and what we must do. A new study in the journal Science finds climate change could push into extinction one out of every six plants and animals on this planet. That's a huge, unimaginable loss. A climate shift won't respect the boundaries of parks and wilderness areas we've set aside. Can we just step back and watch? Emma Maris says no. She's been a reporter for the journal Nature and has a master's in science writing from Johns Hopkins University. Her controversial book is titled Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. Just lately, Emma stirred up another storm among some naturalists with a provocative article in Orion magazine. From Klamath Falls, Oregon, Emma Maris, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this idea of a post-wild world sounds scary to me. What do you mean by that?
Well, in a way, I suppose a subtitle on a popular trade book is meant to be a bit provocative. Because there certainly is still wildness in the world, and there always will be as long as we, let certain places go wild. But the wild places, the wildernesses are, I think, changing a little bit. They are becoming a little less familiar. What I mean by post-wild, in a way, is that there is a sort of a paradox about wildness that has asserted itself in the 21st century. And that is that the places that we think of as being really wild, like Yellowstone or some of the big national parks and provincial parks, those places are actually getting more and more attention and management to keep them looking the way that we want them to look. So there's a lot of people doing a lot of really good and hard work to take out non-native species and to try to figure out what to do about climate change to keep these places looking the way we expect them to look. Meanwhile, there are other places that are not being managed, that are really kind of going wild. Those places are actually changing quite rapidly. A lot of species from other places are moving in. Climate change is changing what thrives and what doesn't thrive. And so those places that we think of as kind of weedy and trashy, you know, under some definitions, those weedy, trashy places are wilder than some of our most landmark protected areas.
Okay, well now getting to the climate change, we always talk about it in human terms. How soon will Miami go underwater? How bad is the heat going to affect our agriculture? How bad do you think climate change will hit the natural world?
I think that is really hard to predict. I do think that the predictions are improving. When we first started asking these questions, I was covering this as a journalist, and there was a sort of envelope model where you just put a circle around where the species was, and then you said, if the conditions changed so much, that where would that envelope move as the climate changed, and would the species be able to keep up? But species are not completely without their adaptive characteristics. They can adapt a little bit just as they are, and in some cases they can even evolve fast enough to track some of this. So we may see some surprises. Maybe some things that we don't expect to be hit hard will be. Maybe some things that we expect to go extinct will survive in unexpected places. It's just really hard to predict, but I do think we are right to be very concerned.
I think another problem is people look at it as individual species. They say, well, okay, if this particular bird moves north, it'll go so far, but what about the bugs that it was eating and all the interrelationships? Things move together.
Right. So in some cases, things might move together. In other cases, things might move so that they no longer overlap, and if they rely on each other, that could be a big problem. The same thing occurs not only in space, but also in time. So if there's a tree that leafs out at a certain type of year, and then that is a food resource for a certain caterpillar, if the leaf out happens earlier and earlier, but the caterpillars continue to be born at the same time, they might wake up to a leaf that's too tough for them to eat. So there's mismatches in time and space that could potentially be problematic. But again, we are learning more and more about how much these species can and cannot adapt, so making really precise predictions is very difficult.
Let's take the example you raised in your Orion article and podcast, the whitebark pine. Tell us about this odd-looking tree and why it matters.
So the whitebark pine is a very interesting member of the pine family. It is a high-altitude specialist. It grows high up on mountaintops and ridges, And it often, in its maturity, looks sort of spectacularly twisted, and parts of the bark have been stripped off to reveal a kind of a shiny white surface underneath, and it often has large bowls from frost damage. So it can be really sort of beautiful as it clings to life in this extreme place at the very top of the tree line. Unfortunately, throughout the West, the whitebark pines are being really hit hard by two different pests. Bark beetles, which are native but seem to be have been sort of released by climate change to be nastier than they would otherwise be, and a blister rust, which is non-native, which was introduced by humans. So under these two threats, the whitebarks are really struggling, and there's a lot of concern that extinction is a possibility. And I write in the piece about Orion about differing ideas about what should be done about that.
And you also write, quote, in 1903, a few years before Theodore Roosevelt declared Grand Canyon a national monument, he urged Americans to, quote, leave it as it is. You cannot improve on it. The ages have been at work on it, and man can only mar it. I generally agree, but you don't. Why?
Well, because I'm worried about these extinctions. So the basic point is that human beings have changed the planet radically, not only in places where it's really obvious, like cities, but also in places where it's not so obvious to the casual viewer, that even in places that seem really wild, we've changed the climate, and that has really put a lot of pressure on those ecosystems. So I feel as if these human changes give us a certain amount of responsibility for the species that we have put at risk. Now, the whitebark pine is a good case study for this because a lot of the whitebark pines that exist in wilderness areas, either places that just seem wild or places that in the U.S. that have been designated as wilderness. So in those places, it's really tough. You don't want to be around messing around too much in these wilderness areas because you want them to remain wild. You don't want to be fiddling around and planting things and uprooting things and girdling competing trees and so on. But on the other hand, there's a real risk that if you don't go into these wilderness areas and start planting some rust-resistant pines, which there's been some efforts to do, or start girdling and cutting back some competing trees that are kind of smothering these whitebark pines, there's a real risk that you might actually lose the whole species. So I guess, you know, it's not always the case, but it is sometimes the case that you have to choose between wilderness and species survival. When faced with that decision, I guess I just really come down on the side of species survival, and I'll tell you why. It's because those species are this real other thing that we need to make sure continue to exist in the world. The world is not all about us. Now, you would say that wilderness is also trying to keep that value alive, the value of places being without us. But paradoxically, I see wilderness as a real human creation because it's all about us. I mean, it's about us not being in a place. It's about a place being human-free. The whole definition of wilderness is contingent on whether or not people are there. So I actually see it as kind of navel-gazy and narcissistic to obsess about wilderness and whether or not we are there. I think we should be less concerned about our relationship with nature and more concerned about the species themselves, that these species continue to exist. I mean, ultimately, the whitebark pine doesn't care whether or not it's in a wilderness area or whether it's in a parking lot. It wants the sunshine. It wants to thrive. It wants to reproduce. I mean, wants. This is a tree. But that's, you know, metaphorically speaking, I think the species is more important than the relationship.
So what is a conservation-reliant species?
So this is a term that was coined by the conservation biologist Michael Scott. And the idea here is that, you know, and there's a lot of degrees of conservation reliance, probably you could argue. But the idea here is to kind of delineate a group of species that are going to need our help for the foreseeable future because things have changed so much for them that they cannot just survive on their own without continued human intervention. So the classic example is the California condor. California condor, if we stopped funding the California condor programs that are currently in place to supplement the population and to train them to avoid power lines and to try to convince hunters not to use lead shot and all these programs, if we stopped them, the bird would almost certainly go extinct. So it is reliant on our continued involvement in its life. You know, I don't love that. I wish that we could just set these species free, we could build up their populations to the point where they were healthy, and we could just walk away and let them be wild and free. But there's a fairly decently sized group of species, not just the condor, but some birds and butterflies that require some burning that we have to do on a regular basis, certainly some species in areas where there's cats and foxes and exotic non-native predators that need to be controlled. All of these species are reliant on us never wavering in our continued attempts to keep them going. And those species, you know, we have to choose between having them be wild and having them exist. And we seem to have chosen that we would prefer to have them exist.
So, Emma, how do you see Dave Foreman's call for rewilding or billionaire Ted Turner's introduction of bison and predators into his vast land holdings?
I think these are great. I think they're wonderful programs. I think it's a real reintroduction of lost species is not only sort of good conservation science because you're kind of putting back together missing pieces of ecosystems, but it's also just a really hopeful, wonderful gesture. Rather than just being defensive about trying to stop future loss, these rewilding projects add, you know, they kind of take a system that has an X amount of species and X amount of excitement and beauty, and they make it more biodiverse and more beautiful and more exciting. So I think they're wonderful. I must admit, quite taken by some of the Pleistocene rewilding proposals that would have us bring back some species that maybe we lost more than 10,000 years ago in North America. You know, you have to evaluate each one on its own merits, and you have to decide, there's not that much money in conservation, so you have to decide where to put your resources. But I think that they're great.
This is Radio EcoShock. We are talking with nature writer and author Emma Morris about our need to intervene to save natural things from climate change. Emma, what is meant by the term new environmentalism?
I don't know. I wrote Rambunctious Garden because I was a journalist following changes in the field of conservation biology. It's really a piece of reporting. I report on a bunch of different conservation biologists who are going in interesting directions, trying new things, and I found them inspiring, and they made me more optimistic about our future than I had been before I started following their work. And around the same time as the book came out, there were some other groups of people and other individuals who were making arguments that were somewhat similar to mine as far as trying to refocus the environmental movement on imagining a good future rather than being kind of more obsessed with returning to this sort of past. So this sort of loose group of people who had similar ideals has been too irresistible to the journalists of the world, and I can't blame them because I'm one of them myself, so I understand how they think. It's been just so irresistible to lump them together and to try to make a movement out of it. I don't think it really was an organic movement. However, the whole thing, the sort of new environmentalists, I don't really know what to think of it. Apart from anything else, I feel like I'd have to sit down and read every single thing that everybody else who's supposedly a new environmentalist ever wrote before I decide whether I want to be called a new environmentalist or not. It's just a category I don't know about. But there seems to be a lively conversation going on in the field of conservation and about what the emphasis should be, how we should orient the field and what kind of things we should be doing. It's a little dismaying sometimes because the dispute, the sort of discussion, the conversation can get a little bit heated and a little bit harsh. And that's really a shame because really, everybody on both sides or all sides or whatever, there's probably 15 sides of discussion about how conservation should move forward. We all are really on the same side. We all care about the non-human world. We all want to see open space preserved. We're all in favor of large protected areas. I mean, the list of the things we agree on is a mile long, and the list of things that we disagree on is really quite short. So it is perhaps a bit dismaying that there's been so much acrimony. I think we're all on team nature here.
Yeah, in the comments on your article at Orion Magazine, some writers say they've been practicing what you preach for decades. And, for example, Kieran Suckling, the executive director at the Center for Biological Diversity, says this new environmentalism isn't new at all. So how do you respond to that?
Well, it's always interested me that perhaps the two most common criticisms of my writing have been that what I'm proposing is heresy and that what I'm proposing is old news. So I don't know which one it is. I guess it depends on how you read it. Kieran is the head of an incredibly powerful and effective conservation group that really takes the government to task on, the U.S. government to task on protecting endangered species. And he does a lot of really good work. I almost wish that he would, you know, spend more time suing the U.S. government and less time leaving comments on my articles. but he's somebody, you know, who should definitely be respected.
And who do you find in your corner agreeing with your views on saving what's left of nature?
Oh, all sorts of people. I very frequently receive emails from people who are land managers who found themselves for many years in a kind of a tough place where they found that they were trying to manage their park or their preserve or their area to a certain reference condition or baseline, and they were finding that more and more difficult as the climate was changing and as non-native species were sort of knocking at the door and trying to come in. And in a lot of cases, you know, I think part of what I write about is that it's very difficult to choose an appropriate baseline in many cases. We don't have all the information about what the system used to look like before it was changed. And more sort of fundamentally, ecosystems are not static entities. They change all the time through time. So you kind of have to pick a time that you want to go back to, and it's not always obvious which is the right time to go back to. So this has been a real struggle for some managers, and I often hear from them that they found a certain amount of relief in realizing that, you know, that another option was to figure out what they and the community and the ecosystem could look like in the future that would be valuable and biodiverse and that would protect rare species and do all these wonderful things, but wouldn't necessarily have to look exactly like it did in 1850 or some particular date. So that's been really liberating, I think, for a lot of people, and I get a lot of fan mail from land managers, which I find, of course, incredibly gratifying.
Well, of course, one big worry is that your proposal could open the door to less sensitive or ethical people for a justification for developing the parks or managing aspects of nature we don't understand very well. I mean, humans are known for their hubris and natural failures. Can we overcome that?
Yeah, I think that's a really legitimate concern. My issue is, what is the alternative? You know, if our paleoecology and our historical ecology is telling us that there was no one perfect state for any ecosystem, you know, that things have been changing, that they've been managed by humans far before Europeans showed up and back into prehistory, and that there's no sort of perfect Garden of Eden moment for most systems, you know, we have to listen to what they're saying. We have to follow the science on this. You know, my other sort of standard reply to this argument is that, you know, it hasn't really stopped developers in the past not to have this argument up their sleeve. They tend to kind of make arguments that are much more focused on, well, this will create jobs, or this will be good for the community, and I think those are probably going to be the arguments that they will continue to use in the future. You know, whether you have to use a historical baseline or whether you can restore to some alternative condition that's premised on biodiversity, it's a little bit of an arcane distinction, I think, for somebody who's trying to build a mall. But I think it is a legitimate worry. It's just that I don't believe in pretending, right? I mean, pretending that there is one right state for a particular ecosystem. It seems misleading. The scientists who study this have sort of moved beyond that framework, and that's what Kieran has always said in his comments on my pieces, that this is not how conservation actually takes place, that they don't look up exactly what an ecosystem looked like in 1850 and then painstakingly recreate it as if it was a work of art. That's not really what goes on. So in a way, what I'm just trying to do is have us talk openly about the way we really do conservation, which is a more forward-looking enterprise and can be more sort of hopeful and optimistic and less about trying to stop loss.
You know, it's interesting to compare environmentalism in the United States with Canada or Europe, where we also broadcast. In Europe, there's practically no original wild space at all, so the discussion there is quite different. And here in Canada, there's so much wilderness, there is no hope or idea that humans could or should manage it. How do you see your proposals for gardening in nature resonating in other parts of the world?
Well, generally speaking, I find that there are a few places that sort of think like the U.S. on this, and one is Australia, and another is many of the Pacific Islands, New Zealand also. So any place where Europeans sort of showed up, got off a boat, and said, look at this virgin wilderness, that sort of set up a kind of a false premise for a lot of places, that there was this sort of unpeopled wilderness that you could then protect or return to. it's a little bit of a sort of a historical construct. Whereas in places like Africa and Europe and Asia, there's been people continuously in these ecosystems for so many thousands of years that it's not this sort of notion that, that you could find a place without people doesn't occur or appeal or have the same kind of romantic resonance. So, yeah, I mean, I once gave a talk in the Netherlands and to a bunch of ecology students, and after I gave my talk, they were kind of like, yeah, so? This is exactly how we've always done things here. You know, sort of saying, okay, here's a piece of land. You know, what kind of good work can we do here? What kind of species conservation can we do here? So, yeah, it's definitely different. And Canada is an interesting case. I mean, it certainly, Canada has myth of the idea that, that all of this was virgin wilderness when the first people arrived, the first European people, rather. But clearly that's not the case. I mean, there's been people living in Canada for thousands of years, and they have done a lot of things on the landscape, from, you know, managing game populations through hunting to burning to planting camas bulbs and then harvesting them in certain designated areas. It's sort of a huge amount of human management going way back. You know, some of the places that I visited in Canada for the book were interesting because what they were really restoring to was to that indigenous management. You know, there's some Garry Oak Savanna preserves on Vancouver Island, for example, that I talk about in my book. Really beautiful places with Garry Oaks and then a carpet of camas underneath. And those were essentially those were human-created ecosystems because they were kept open from incursion by Doug Firs by kind of maintaining them through fire. So in a way, we've already been doing this. We've already been restoring to states that we like as humans that are kind of collaborations between humanity and nature.
So where does this discussion go from here? Emma, what do you want to see changed?
You know, my original book was a bit of reporting, and I've done some reporting on these kinds of topics since. The change is happening. We don't need to pass any law or change anything. I think that as climate change moves species around, there are going to be some real legal challenges in the various national versions of endangered species rules and acts, because we have a kind of a legal framework that species occur in a certain area and they don't really move. But they're going to be moving as the climate changes, and then we have to figure out how to account for that. But, you know, a lot of what I talk about is already going on, and what I'm really trying to do is just bring this change in focus that's in the scientific field out into the public so we can all be charmed by it, I guess, because I find it really exciting, you know, that we're not just going to stand by and watch climate change ravage these species, that we're going to try to do something about it, that we're going to maybe even consider moving some species to places where they can survive better as the climate changes, that we're going to, you know, take responsibility for the world we've created.
More recently, you've been writing about wolves using a platform called Beacon. What's going on with wolves, and what is Beacon?
Well, Beacon is a crowd-funded journalistic platform. So the idea is it's kind of like Netflix. You can subscribe to a journalist that you're interested in for $5 a month, and then, you know, you can read all their stories. So it kind of cuts out the middleman of the magazine, so to speak. And I've been working on this wolf project. Originally I was going to write a book, and I may still do that, but I'm having a lot of fun just writing the individual stories. It started out as a sort of a related question. I was interested in whether the reintroduced wolves in the lower 48 states here could really be considered that wild, because so many of them have GPS tracking collars, and they have designated numbers, and we know where they are, and we know who their parents were, and we know who their pups are, and we're sort of, and if they get too close to livestock, we run around and shoot them with rubber bullets, and they seem to be living a life that's very well known, and that's kind of circumscribed by humans. And I was interested in sort of where is the wildness in the wolf? Is it in his, you know, in the genome? Is it in the behavior? Is it in whether or not we know where they are? I mean, I often think about, you know, comparing the wolf that lives near me in Klamath Falls that has both a scientific designation and a nickname and a collar, and we know exactly where he is, and we know how many pups he has, and comparing that to some wolf in Alberta or BC far off into the mountains that's never seen a human and never will, it seems as if it's a different category. But as I've been writing it, the pieces, I've become really interested in the sort of eternal question of whether or not you can know what it's like to be another species, to be an animal. Of course, the answer is no, but that doesn't stop us from trying. And I've been writing the stories of individual wolves as much as I can piece them together through official records and collar data and so forth, and just trying to understand what it's like to be a wolf in the 21st century in a crowded part of the world, well, relatively speaking. So there are some wolves in Europe that live in some seriously crowded places, just on the outskirts of big cities in Italy and other parts of Europe, and that's a really fascinating setup.
Good Lord, what's next? Wolves with iPhones, I suppose.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the idea that, you know, these biologists are getting text messages with updates of where these wolves are, it just seemed like such a paradox to me. Here's the icon of the wilderness, and it's sending you text messages. So I thought that was really interesting.
We're going to have to wrap it up there. From Klamath Falls, Oregon, our guest Emma Maris, and that's Maris with two R's, is the author of Rambunctious Garden, Saving Nature in a Post-Wild World. You can find out more at emmamaris.com, and you can also find links to her work and her recent article in Orion Magazine in my Radio EcoShock blog at ecoshock.info, published every Wednesday. Emma, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.